Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, and Las Cruces Community Radio, KTAL LP at 101.5 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, a local nonprofit working to protect the Gila watershed through advocacy, education, and restoration. On today's show, we're featuring a panel discussion from the 2020 Gila River Festival. This presentation was recorded on September 18th, 2020, and it's still very relevant. It's called Assuring a Resilient Water Future for Southwest New Mexico. There are three speakers on this panel: Priscilla Lucero, the Executive Director of the Southwest Council of Governments; geologist and Interstate Stream Commissioner Stacy Timmons; and Norm Gom. Many of our listeners will recognize Norm's name because he's been a very vocal critic of the New Mexico CAP entity and its efforts to divert the Gila River. Moderating the panel is realtor and eco-broker Sissy McAndrew, who currently serves as the director of the Southwest New Mexico Green Chamber of Commerce. She's also a longtime supporter of the Gila River Festival. Sissy will tell you more about each of the speakers, so I'll let her do that. This presentation was originally a video recording, and there are a few places where the speaker refers to a visual, such as a photo, a map, or a graph, and you radio listeners will have to use your imagination. For the most part, however, this presentation translates quite well from video to audio. We'll begin now with an introduction by moderator Sissy McAndrew.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Assuring a Resilient Water Future for Southwest New Mexico. We're going to discuss steps towards improving the resilience of Southwest New Mexico water uses. Our panelists will present practical water supply sustainability and resiliency concepts applicable to the region, problems and barriers to overcome, and project ideas that would increase water supply resilience in the face of aquifer mining and climate change. I'm Sissy McAndrew, an eco-broker and green realtor at United Country Members Realty in Silver City, New Mexico, and also the executive director of the Southwest New Mexico Green Chamber of Commerce. I've been a major sponsor of the River Festival for years, and I'm thrilled to be your moderator today. Our speakers today are Stacy Timmons. Stacy, who directs the Geology Division of the Aquifer Mapping Program with the State Geological Survey for the New Mexico Bureau of Geology and Mineral Resources at New Mexico Tech, has worked throughout the state on hydrologic and geologic research topics, a variety of water data collection, and integration endeavors for the last 15 years, as well as the Aquifer Mapping Program. Since 2019, Stacy has served on the Water Quality Control Commission and the Interstate Stream Commission, and she is leading the implementation of the Water Data Act legislation. Norm Gom, who is mostly retired, that's funny, he's very, very active. He's a licensed water engineer. He grew up in southern New Mexico, receiving his BS and MS degrees in electrical and civil engineering from New Mexico State University. His career includes 4 years with the water resource modeling engineering firm, 19 years with the city of Albuquerque, 6 years as a director of the New Mexico Interstate Stream Commission, and 12 years as a self-employed consulting engineer. He has been a tireless advocate for the Gila River, and I've had the honor of testifying with him at the New Mexico legislature and discussing water resources with him on Earth Matters, a radio program at KURU, our community radio station here in Silver City. Priscilla Lucero has been employed by the Southwest New Mexico Council of Governments since 1987 and has been the executive director for the past 17 years. She provides technical assistance to local governments in Catron, Grant, Hidalgo, and Luna counties in the areas of economic development, transportation, housing, water and wastewater infrastructure, legislative and community development. She and I have worked together on multiple projects, and I have witnessed her continued successes through the year. Good morning, Priscilla. What's our water future look like?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you and talk about some of our most critical and livelihood needs, which is absolutely the role that water plays. And I think I couldn't, I think one of the best ways to start this conversation is really to talk about what has happened and some of the challenges that I've faced during my career. But it's also a way to really acknowledge about some of the things that we see happening in the region with regards to water. So I wanted to start out with a story. And this one story was when I was a community development planner working in through the Council of Governments, where we had the unincorporated community of Hanover ran out of water. So Hanover ran out of water in 2010. It's primarily consisted of individuals that were from an elderly population. And you can see from the slide that's presented before you, there's about a population of 167 people and about 93 connections approximately. I think this was the one story in my career that really opened my eyes to the impacts of what it could mean to a householder or a family or the vulnerable populations in regards to the lack of not having adequate water supply. I've dealt with water issues all of my career, but I think this one was mostly most impactful from the standpoint that when I saw an elderly person that could not actually lift a pail to be able to provide some kind of water source for themselves was a critical issue for me. If you look on the presentations, you see a bottled water there and an aluminum can. Those were the methods that were provided, how we provided water to those residents for a number of weeks in 2010. And that was at the graciousness of Anheuser-Busch. And I've saved this as part of my collection to continually remind me of the value of our water. Also, you'll see in the slide below that is a water tender that was brought in by the National Guard to help provide water. What most people don't realize is that water is also a need when you're dealing with this vulnerable population that is the elderly, children, those people with health issues, et cetera. But the one thing that was really unique about Hanover was that there was no way to bring any emergency water supply to them except for the methods that you're seeing on the screen today. We even had thoughts about bringing a tanker full of water and then providing the water and putting it into the storage tank. And that was impossible to do just because of the terrain in which the storage tanks were housed. So this was one where we tried every possibility to think of solutions to be able to provide water to these individuals. And it was not an easy task. I think this is where you begin to learn and appreciate the little things in life and how important that is and how it's just as much our responsibility to educate others on why this is such a basic need to for our livelihood of our communities and so for our future. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. But not only did that happen in 2010, we thought that we had resolved an issue. We got emergency funding, not emergency funding, but funding from USDA. But let me tell you, from the time that you start planning the project to the time of construction, you're talking an average period of about 3 years, if you're lucky. So if an emergency occurs today, there's no way that we're going to be able to alleviate it in the time frame that we would all like it to. And I want people to be cognizant of that, because there's many other issues that attribute to how we provide that adequate water supply when there is no other place to turn on a meter to say to provide that water. There's so many different pieces of that. But that was taken care of probably halfway through, maybe in 2015. But then here we are again in 2019 dealing with some new circumstances and new issues around providing the water supply. Little did we know that there was a cap in the amount of money that could be provided as that emergency water supply. That was one issue. But then there was also an issue about how that local community could provide and pay for that water itself. So you had a number of issues going on here. So I wanted to kind of share that story to kind of preface what we're going to talk about today and why it is that it's so important. And I just want you to think about as we go through this presentation today, what it would be like for you to be with a day without water. Just imagine one day without that. And then I want you to imagine that what it would be like if that went to a week, to a month, and to months. And I think that would kind of put a little bit different perspective on all of us as to why we have to conserve our water and why it's important that we take care and that we provide adequate water for our own livelihoods. So with that, Cynthia, I'll turn it back over to you. And I believe Stacy is probably the next person in line to continue the presentation.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for inviting this panel to present and talk about water resiliency. I wanted to kind of start from what Priscilla talked about and give it a little bit of geologic and scientific context. So here in the southwest part of the state, the geology is pretty complicated, and I'm going to simplify it down to just two rough categories of where our groundwater comes from in this area. On the map, which hopefully you can see general characteristics, yellow and beige and pinks and a little bit of maybe blues, those yellows and beige units on the map are representing outcrops of the Gila group primarily and other alluvial materials. These are aquifers that are generally a few hundred feet thick, coarser at the top, meaning better water usually. Some of the most productive wells in the southwest part of the state are in this unit, and Silver City's drinking water wells are coming from this kind of category of aquifer. So if nothing else today, if you come away from this knowing where your water comes from, I think that's a huge success. The area that we were just talking about in Hanover is indicated on the image. If you can see a little red star outlined in yellow, kind of in the center of the map, that's where Hanover is. And that area is surrounded by volcanic rocks, other bedrock, carbonate limestone rocks. Primarily the aquifers in those units are fractured bedrock. They have much less water in storage. Basically, the water is within the fractures, not so much distributed throughout the rock as it is in the Gila group. Just two totally different types of aquifers in this area, and a lot that we don't quite know. One thing I wanted to point out that some previous work that was done in the late 90s and reported in 2000 by John Holly and several others indicates that the total groundwater in storage for the Southwest region is around or less than 50 million acre feet, and that most of it exists in the Mimbres Basin, which is that area kind of shaded out in blue now, and that's about 30 million acre feet to begin with prior to any pumping. So that's the kind of groundwater picture that we have at this point. And I would just add that there is a lot of very site-specific information that we don't have. And there's a lot that's unknown about the depth. So as you go deeper, the formations and their aquifer characteristics change. And so in order to try to answer the question of how much water do we have in total, like this estimate here of 50 million acre feet, is it's hard to do unless you can really carefully characterize the base and the surrounding boundaries of the aquifers. And that has not really been performed in this area. Adding to some of the challenges that we have to think about in terms of a resilient water future, we really have to come to grips with the fact that the climate is changing and already has changed significantly, and that will affect our water resources. The temperature graph that you can see maybe on the top left corner of the screen shows that the temperature has already risen about 3 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 80s. And so we're already feeling the impacts of that. That comes with increasing aridity. So the air is thirstier and takes more water out of the plants, of the water bodies. That is an increasing evaporation effect. The other kind of effects that really have an impact to this region is that we'll be seeing decreasing snowpack, as well as reduced amount of groundwater recharge to these aquifers that are already limited. And I just came across a comment recently noting that August of this year, this is just adding to the horrible things about 2020, but August of this year was a record mean annual or mean monthly temperature amongst the last century. So when we compare August temperatures this year compared to all the previous years in the 20th century, we're seeing that it was about three to six degrees warmer than previous August on record. And kind of an interesting way to put that into perspective for how that relates to our future is that this August 2020 will be one of the cooler months of the next century. So let that kind of sink in with you a little bit. Things are changing. And some of the things that we're starting to see in terms of the groundwater in the region is a little concerning, which is that we're seeing groundwater levels that have been declining for decades. The map on the right-hand side is showing the Mimbres Basin. You can see Deming in the center. There's a couple of places where we've got long history of groundwater level measurements. And the graphs that you show that are showing on the left-hand side are indicating those groundwater level measurements over time. So back in the 1960s up until early 2020, it was when some of these last measurements were. 100 feet decline over a 60-year period in one, and 115 feet decline all the way down by Columbus over the last 60 years. And so that basically tells us that we are mining the aquifer, that the amount of water going into the aquifer is much less than what's being taken out. Some of the impacts of that that's been seen in previous decades is the fact that there are fissures that formed in the late 80s, in the 80s when pumping was at a maximum for some of this area. This is down in the area by just south of Deming. There's a green box in the map on the right-hand side. Sorry, it's over here on my side and in the middle on yours. So just south of Deming, there was some land fissures and then also land subsidence. So you can see in the guy that's standing there next to a big wellhead that the well is staying in the same place, but the land has gone down about a foot. So that was noted in the late 80s. And then even now, if you were to look on some of the Google Earth images, you can start to pick out where these fissures are. So this is along, I think it's County Road 41 or 3. So you can see these areas that it's basically where there's been so much water withdrawn that the land surface has collapsed and cracked open. And so I've outlined some of those fissures on the image on the right-hand side. This mostly occurred in the 80s and is a reason for some of the big changes that happened with irrigation in that area at that time. Some of the other parts of the Mimbres Basin, we do see some more positive changes where groundwater levels were declining going into the 80s, and then things turned around to some extent. So over to the east of the Florida Mountains, we have a well that's come up about 13 feet in the last 50 years. And then further to the north, in the area southeast of Hurley, you can see a well where the groundwater level has risen about 150 feet over 35 years. The point I have to make about this is that there has been a dramatic drop off in the number of places that are being monitored in the state of New Mexico, and especially in the southwest part of New Mexico. The image up on the top here just shows several decades, the 50s, the 80s, the 2000s, and 2010s, and number of measurements in New Mexico being done during those periods. That's also graphically shown on the bottom. And there's a general trend of decreasing measurements that's been happening. A lot of that is because of decreasing funding to the monitoring effort that needs to be done. A lot of this is performed by the State Engineer's Office in collaboration now with the USGS. That is presently under revision, but my understanding is that it's on the order of something like 600 wells per year that's going to be able to be measured all across the state. So that's probably not enough if I had my way. And I just wanted to highlight specifically to the Mimbres Basin, there has been a dramatic decrease to the number of sites that are being monitored. And you can see here on a graph, it's measurement on the x-axis and year across the, y-axis, x-axis is year. The number of measurements has gone down from on the order of 500 wells in the Mimbres Basin alone done in the 80s to where we're at now, which is about 100. We, at the agency that I work at, the State Geologic Survey, we just went back out noticing that there hadn't been measurements done in this area, and we were able to get 113 sites measured in January and February of 2020. And the fact of the matter is that it is a very labor and time intensive process to do these measurements, but without this data, we can't tell where we stand. So we need to know if it's going up or going down. It's essential to making decisions and plans about our water. So I just kind of wanted to make a few points for the conversation here. And I firmly believe that our decisions should not be guided by a Ouija board or someone's opinion, but should be rather decided by a scientific decision-making process based in data. And so in this region specifically, I think that there's a need for much more detailed research of the aquifers in this area. So the kind of work where you go out and make a bunch of measurements on wells, drill some new wells to provide more information, do a bunch of water quality sampling, get a sense of how old the water is. That sort of thing needs to be done to really try to map out and characterize the aquifers in detail in this area. Another thing that I think this region needs to be thinking about is how to rebuild or build up groundwater monitoring efforts. The work that I talked about where we went out to the Mimbres is also done in conjunction with a collaborative groundwater monitoring network that we run. And there's a lot of places around the state where the wells are ideal for doing continuous or periodic measurements of groundwater wells. And so you could volunteer your well, if you have one, to see if it would fit into this network, either it's in a good location or with a well that does work for the instruments that we have. And then another, I think, important part to this whole thing is to make sure that the data that are being collected are open and easily accessible. I do know that there are some other measurements that get done in the southwest part of the state, but the data are either on paper or in a file cabinet somewhere, or are otherwise somewhat hard to access. So making the data open and accessible for some of the work that we're doing with the Water Data Act would be really helpful to better characterize and better understand what's going on in this area. That's all I have. I'm off to you, Norm.
I just wanted to start by saying I have tremendous respect for Stacy and Priscilla and the leadership that they've provided in their respective areas. Thank you very much. I want to tell a couple of stories to begin with. First of all, Stacy showed some hydrographs of groundwater level decline that over 100 feet over the last 60 years. 60 years ago was about when I moved away from Deming, where I went to grade school. And one of the things my mother was scared to death about, you know, I hung out with a pack of 12-year-old boys with bicycles, BB guns, and bows and arrows, and we roamed the desert. And she was so worried that I would fall into one of the shallow hand-dug wells that at that time existed all over the countryside around Deming, indicating that once upon a time, the groundwater level was at the surface. And, you know, since I've learned that that in fact was the case, before groundwater extraction, the groundwater was recharged and it flowed toward the southern end of the basin, and the groundwater tables were very shallow. Those wells were dry when I was 12, and the groundwater tables have declined over 100 feet since. I want to explain plain truths. That's my other story. I have led two major water planning efforts in the state of New Mexico, one with the city of Albuquerque seeking a sustainable water supply, and the other seeking a plan to comply in perpetuity with the requirements of the Pecos River Compact and a Supreme Court decree that resulted from a state of Texas lawsuit. In both of those efforts, it was very useful to reduce the essence of the problem to plain truths. You know, and these were agreed plain truths. One of the first things we did in the planning process is to try to get agreement on the facts and science, because that's where you have to start. Now, I have way too many plain truths in, you know, my short presentation, you know, to really qualify as a few plain truths, but I think it is something that planning for a sustainable, resilient water future in Southwest New Mexico should begin with. What are the plain truths of the existing situation that demand change? So Stacy discussed the plain truths of climate disruption. We're going to have higher temperatures, which will drive our demand for water up, which will increase the gap between water supply and demand. At the same time, our storm intensities are likely to increase. And who knows, you know, how the population will respond. Will we be seeing climate change, refugees relocating to Southwest New Mexico? I don't know the answer to that. We will have lower amounts of water in our rivers and streams. As Stacy said, we'll have lower recharge to our aquifers. We'll have lower amounts of groundwater volumes remaining in aquifer storage. And we'll have lower water supply resilience if we increase business as usual. Maybe the very last one would begin to rise to one of the real plain truths. Plain truths, we had climate, now it's plain truths with regard to water supplies. So the truths with regard to our water supplies vary, whether you're talking about groundwater or surface water. And with respect to groundwater, where in the member's basin aquifer system you're discussing. So in the member's basin, as Stacy pointed out, vast amounts of water have been used up. It's gone. The aquifer system is highly variable spatially. You know, the Florida Mountains and all of these other desert peaks poke out, and clearly there's no groundwater or very limited groundwater there. But the whole area is not well enough understood to do a reliable plan. We have major irrigation overuse of groundwater. The irrigation uses of groundwater are not sustainable. As Stacy mounted the said, the pumping amounts are not metered, and the effects of pumping on the groundwater table are not well monitored, and that has that was reduced to a crisis level recently, which I applaud Stacy for stepping in and trying to fix. She mentioned the deep aquifers. The deep portions of the aquifers are poorly understood. I think that reliance on them is likely speculative, but I think the bottom line is that the uses of groundwater from the member's basin aquifer system are not sustainable. Surface water from the Gila River Basin, we know that the river yield will decrease with increasing temperature and natural demands, but something people may not realize is that New Mexico's decreed superior share is fixed. It will not change. It's not affected by natural depletions. It's only measured in context with human diversions. And that amount is fixed. And frankly, the water right is the best on the river because it's closest to the source and it can be exercised any time of year. No one can call the amount of water that is decreed for New Mexico's use. The annual water supplies are sustainable, but the seasonal distribution of those supplies is going to change with climate disruption. And if the Arizona Water Settlements Act, Gila diversion ordeal taught us anything, it's that flood flows are incredibly expensive to develop and that they don't result in a reliable supply. Next slide. breaking the Membris base in Oxford down into two principal areas. In the area around Deming, there's extensive irrigation supplied by groundwater mining. Once upon a time, Deming area crops were high value. I went back there recently and looked up one of my best friends when I went to grade school there. In fact, we went to engineering school together. He told me that a lack of labor required him to shift to low-value crops that he could harvest with mechanical harvester. So whereas once upon a time the crops were high value and he made a lot of money, now he grows alfalfa and it's all that, and he and his son-in-law can harvest it and make a living, but there are no other jobs. So in terms of the jobs and economic benefit per acre foot of water use, you know, it's gone down substantially. I believe that domestic and municipal use would be resilient, that Deming's domestic and municipal use and uses in those areas would be resilient without ag uses. We've already talked about the poor understanding of groundwater. I think another theme for the scientific investigations that I hope begin is areas of unused groundwater that we might find should be reserved for remote municipal well fields, you know, dedicated to the areas Deming and Columbus that are likely to have future problems. In the Silver City area, the mining district wells that are located in the bedrock fringe at the edge of the Members Basin aquifer can be expected to fail. The aquifer is thick there. There's actually a state engineer report in 2002 that goes over that. The regional water supply system that is planned but not yet funded will meet needs with resilience. Obviously, that's had some challenges, but it's a very good project, and those problems need to be worked out. The project needs to be fully funded and built. And then I make one other observation with respect to the Silver City area. Copper mining entities own vast amounts of water rights, and the depletions that mining has made of stored groundwater and the amounts that are used are not well understood publicly. There's very little data that comes out of the state engineer's office with respect to water use, and that needs to change. Next slide. Changes are needed. You know, here's another plain truth. We must change. Water is the basis for lives and the economy in Southwest New Mexico. But the existing uses are much too high to be resilient, the ag uses in Deming in particular. Water supply infrastructure requires capital and annual funding. That's always been a problem. It requires certified operators to operate the water and wastewater infrastructure, and those are few and far between. And it requires planned maintenance and replacements, and I'm not sure how well that those are performed. But I suspect that all are problems. And as has been pointed out, the grant funding is not sustainable or reliable. So money is most definitely an issue. Funding right now, I think it's on the order of $72 million from the New Mexico Unit Fund is available for effective water infrastructure projects. Yet those projects have not been funded from the beginning of the process. And my last slide. Despite the fact that there is a document on people's shelves called the Southwest New Mexico Water Plan, the region doesn't have a decent water plan. As Stacy made clear, the science and data required to create a reliable plan doesn't exist. And therefore, going after the scientific investigations and gathering the data and making it available and assuring its quality is step one. A plan is absolutely required as the beginning to implementation of anything complex, and it needs to be worked out and it needs to have integrity. So leadership and a critical mass of demand to prepare an objective water plan are the things that are needed right now. And I'm going to close on kind of a negative note. But I have continued to observe the New Mexico CAP entity in their telephonic meetings under COVID. And it's my opinion that they've demonstrated that they're incapable of clear thinking and constructive expenditures and decision making. Their discussions amongst themselves in public meetings indicate to me that they've learned nothing from their expensive failure and their waste of $16 million. Their members seem fixated on Arizona Water Settlements Act water development, even though their experience shows that it's not economically possible. Their members express entitlement to the entire remainder of the New Mexico Unit Fund that has been plainly stated in meetings, and their leadership and their member public statements pertaining to climate change are all denial. So I know that they want to continue to control the process, but I am hopeful that the local governments of Southwest New Mexico will instead appoint a representative group of citizens to come up with what the future will look like in Southwest New Mexico. Thank you.
Thank you, Norm. We do have a question in the Q&A. Why has funding for monitoring wells decreased?
One of the things that's really important as part of water or anything is really creating resilient water supplies. So we have to look at things from a much bigger picture than probably we've ever thought of. And so I've seen that through my career. And so if you look at column one, we look at the clean, safe, and affordable water service. Many of us sometimes, as I have learned through my career, are unaware about what it really entails to provide an adequate water supply. What does that mean cost-wise? What is the pipe made out of? All kinds of things that you have to think of while you're trying to deliver water. So first of all, you must have adequate water. You must have reliable water supply. And then, is the water affordable? There's all kinds of things that could need, that will be looked at to determine where you have the sustainability of that water supply. And then most importantly, from a grant source, you're starting to see more and more where they want this critical infrastructure to be managed and looking at the replacement of those, of that asset. And so that's what funders are looking at to ensure that the public dollar is invested and invested well. The other column you see there is community economic benefits of water infrastructure. Most importantly, water creates jobs, and that's a livelihood to the community as well. It creates career opportunity. It revitalizes neighborhoods. It creates business opportunities and business development, as well as housing opportunities. So as a person who works in economic development, our comprehensive economic development strategy, which is now a requirement from any federal economic development agency, is that we are required to put what are some of these measures that affect resiliency with whatever we're tackling at that point. If that is not addressed, because as we have seen just in the last few months, we've been through pandemic, we've been through a number of fires, we've been through flooding, we've been through all kinds of things. And so we have to look at what are some of those impacts from every perspective, right? So community resilience, here are some of the others that I think I might have already mentioned, but flood, there's drought, there's climate risk, there's economics, water reuse, water loss. It's incredible to me sometimes working with water districts or water or municipal water systems, the amount of water loss. And so not really realizing what that means to us in the long term, correct? And then water security. So one of the projects that Norm was talking about and that I wanted to bring up as one of the projects that we've been focusing on for a number of years. If we go back and look at this Grant County Regional Water Project, this goes back to the very inception from planning, which dates back to 2006. Here we are, 2020. That is an indicator of how much planning and effort has gone into this project and why it's so important for the livelihoods of our communities here. So we are barely in the phase 1A, and that is to provide the town of Hurley their own water supply. That is the cost of what it's costing them to provide a water supply for their own use. What you don't see in this slide is the amount of investment that's already occurred by every local government within this county and every water association that has invested to doing improvements to their water system so that they can eventually become this Grant County Regional Water Project. That current dollar amount to date is $19 million of investment to that would lead to these other future phases for that connectivity. And there's probably more than is probably unaccounted for. But you can see that there's been a great wealth of work towards that so that we can actually sustain our communities for health and safety and also for providing future economic opportunities for our communities. Next slide, Stacy. So these are just a few examples that I wanted to give about some future projects. And this is one, a few of many. So one thing I want to share with you is that when I started in my career back in the early 90s in the planning perspective of water, some of these projects that I worked on in the 90s are now at the point where they need replacement. Because I've been through that whole cycle from the very beginning, from planning to where they received funding the first time around, to include people that didn't have water to have adequate water. And now 30 years later, we're at a point that the asset has to be looked at, has to be maintained. What is it we need to do to replace that so that we can continue that adequate water supply? Many water systems in my career that I have worked with have been privately owned. And those privately owned systems, in some cases, were not maintained at all in the 30 years of their existence or beyond that. So what happens is that when you start to do that, you start to put people in jeopardy of the quality of water, but you also start to have to think about how that impacts the value of your property and what is going to be the long-term water for providing water to your community. Those are things that most people don't think about when we're talking about these projects. This is a huge learning curve for me, and I've learned some wonderful things from some of these great mentors like Stacy and Norm about the water. I know most of the funding side of it and what that entails. And let me tell you, the funding perspective is not an easy one because you got to understand the state rule. You got to understand the federal rule. How do they mesh? They don't mesh. How do you make a mesh? And so that's a much more complicated process than most people realize. And you're trying to provide just a basic need. That's only one need that these communities have to deal with on a daily basis, right? So what I do as part of my work is I work with developing capital improvement plans. And I can tell you that in every single plan, there is something as far as the list of doing either replacement of water systems or upgrading of water systems or whatever that may be and planning for the future so that we can sustain that water system while keeping it affordable, right? We are extremely fortunate in this region because of some of our designations that we get grant dollars, but not everybody is that fortunate. And so I just want to acknowledge that. And Norm is correct. There's no guarantee that those grant dollars are going to be there tomorrow. I think we're fortunate that we do take some of the other states' money just because we know the processes and we take advantage of that. But you can see here on this graph some of the projects that are already in the works. And as you can see, they're high dollar projects. One of the ones that I've worked with most recently is Casas Adobes. That was one of those systems that was privately owned and needed 30 years, that had gone 30 years without repair. And that's the cost of just trying to do the replacement. That doesn't include the cost of what it was to deal with the emergencies of the lack of providing and maintaining that asset. And then there's much more. So what I want to say before we open it up to questions is that please be cognizant of the cost of providing water to your residents, to the communities, for the purposes of economic development. And so we have to begin to educate ourselves now so that we can maintain our water supply. And then lastly, I just took an estimate, and I'm sure there's many that are still missing from this, but I wanted to take an estimate of what are some of the water needs in our communities. And this does not include some of the ones that actually mentioning above. And every day, there's something that happens within an unincorporated community or incorporated in which we have an emergency type of situation, or there's something that's changing within the aquifer, or there's something that's happening with the asset. And so this number could fluctuate, right, daily. But I put an estimate that about over $60 million is still needed to do the much needed improvements that would impact over 63,000 individuals in this region. I will tell you that there's nothing more important to me in the career that I do, that I work in, how water has opened my eyes to the many things. And without that, that's a basic need in everything that we do. Without that, and if we don't invest in that, then we have no future. I just can't reiterate that from a human perspective, is that think about the vulnerability of these seniors who have no one to help them lift a pail of water to be able to deal with that emergency. There's nothing more frightening for a family member who can't provide adequate and treated water for their family members. Those are the things that I hear on a daily basis without people really understanding that, number one, the way systems were installed back then, maybe may not have been made out of the best materials. Second of all, that everything has to be replaced at some point or another. These are only things that we're talking about that are being replaced, that need to be replaced. We're not talking about those dollars that we are going to need just to replace those things in 30 years or 20 years based on when was the last time an organization was funded. So I'm a big advocate and I do everything in my power with partnerships like Norm and Stacy to make sure that we have our most basic need met for our livelihoods of this region. And I also look at it from a state perspective as well in my advocacy for really helping the most rural frontier communities. Sissy?
Let me ask a question, and whoever would like to answer this one. The state engineer's office permits wells, and when are they going to honestly start regulating? I know the Gila and San Francisco Basin, they keep track of that. Those are metered. But I mean, it seems like, I know in real estate, we're continually drilling more wells. When is it going to get to where we look back at the consumption levels that have been approved and we actually start regulating to try to control some of this overuse of our water? Stacy, do you want to field that one at all?
Well, I don't know if I have an answer to the when part of the question, but I think it's a really good question, Sissy, and one that we need to elevate to our policymakers and kind of raise the awareness of this concern. I don't work in a regulatory realm, but in my limited experience on that, it seems to me that the communities are kind of left with the choices, but not a whole lot of the power that's needed or a clear understanding of how they can implement that. Maybe Norm would be better to speak to that from his perspective as a former director at the ISC. But it has been my impression that there has not been real solid policy to do something to that effect. I do see that as a major problem, though, and something that I would love to see policy change toward kind of more of a regulatory role for the state engineer on that particular piece.
We do have one. Do you have any idea of the net Gila River aquifer withdrawals versus replenishment? In other words, CAPE thinks all 14,400 acre feet of Gila should be New Mexico's. How much are current users depleting the groundwater?
So I can only speak to the limited amount of data that I've seen along the Gila. I don't see a huge amount of groundwater decline from the very small number of wells that have been monitored, but that is one of those areas where I think we're that really lacking a clear picture of what's going on in the groundwater around there. But right around the river, I don't think it changes except for a seasonal kind of trend. When there's more water in the river, there's more water in the aquifer. But I don't have a good pulse on the broader region around there myself. I don't know if that question is entirely about groundwater or also about surface water. But yeah, that's my two cents on that. I don't have a clear picture because I don't think there's enough data.
Well, Stacy, if somebody wants to participate in the program and actually put in monitoring systems and wells, how can they go about that? Is that something that can be privately funded? And where? How would they get in touch with somebody to start that process?
Yeah, so we have worked in a number of different regions in a variety of ways to build a groundwater monitoring program. Anywhere from a small community where we have 10 to 15 wells that we go out and measure once a year with a manual measurement to public supply wells where we're able to instrument them with a real-time monitoring device so they can actually track groundwater levels. I would encourage you to reach out to me. My email is on here on the screen now. And then I can point you to some other information with a program that we have, the Collaborative Groundwater Monitoring Network for New Mexico, which is privately funded through the Healy Foundation for the most part, along with our aquifer mapping program. So we're able to provide that kind of outreach to communities. And so if people have a well that they're interested in having monitored, we can check it out, get on the list of wells. We really have a lack of information there in Southwest New Mexico. So I encourage people to at least reach out and see if we can build that variety of different ways kind of program.
No, I remember on a radio show one time when PNM was starting to try to sell air conditioners and saying they were saving water from people having evaporative coolers. And I asked Norm about that, and he said it's not as much the domestic consumption, but it is the irrigation, and it's a commercial and industrial use. So that may be the answer, and we can definitely hopefully get an answer from Norm later on and get that out to people. Priscilla, I have a question here. It deals with politics and legislative action. And what would it take to dissolve the current MCAP entity and replace members with people who are competent, who are diverse, representatives of various stakeholders who are not in denial?
So, you know, I don't know that I have the full answer to that, but all I could say from meetings that I've attended in the past through in legislative interim committees, that at the end of the day is that the legislators have all authority to do what they think is fit for the benefit of this region. And that's something that at least I've heard. And I think probably, Stacy, I think you might have been in one of those meetings where that was something that was discussed. And I think they have that authority. So my ultimate goal is always going to be to make sure that we have our basic need, you know, because if you really look at what, how many days we could live without water, it's not very many days. It's about 3 days. And I've got to say that I did attend a national conference in Washington, D.C. And, you know, and I'm very protective of my communities and most especially of the Grant County Regional Water Project. But when you're surrounded by people that are from Flint, Michigan, it just made me realize how blessed we are and that we have to just really work collaboratively to really look at what's in the best interest for all people so that we can provide our basic need. And that's kind of where I come from and everything that I do. It's about the people. And that's how I see things. And that's my vision.
Thank you also very much, panelists, and thank you, all the participants. We're so glad to have you hearing about our area. We hope you're as concerned as we are, and thanks for having all the professionalism and knowledge that we have. We all work together, and we've gone a long way right now, and I think we can continue to collaborate in the future for sustaining our water resources. Thank you, everybody.
I'd like to thank today's panelists from the 16th Annual Gila River Festival, Priscilla Lucero, Stacy Timmons, and Norm Gom, for talking about the future of water resilience in Southwest New Mexico. And also, I'd like to thank moderator Sissy McAndrew, a local realtor and longtime supporter of the Gila River Festival. Many thanks to audio engineer Marcus Hansen, and to the board of directors of Gila Members Community Radio for keeping the station on the air during these very challenging times. And many thanks to you, our listeners, for supporting the station and tuning into this week's program. I'm Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, and Las Cruces Community Radio, KTAL LP, at 101.5 FM. Please be well and safe out there for your own sake and for others. This is what community radio looks like.